Accession number 12503, Reel 3.
Commander Lang, Reel 3.
We were sent off to do a sweep astern as the fleet was retiring from Dakar towards Freetown. And we were about to come back, when about 50 miles out, when I saw on the horizon, on a very calm sea, surface of a very calm sea, under about 3,000 feet, 10/10 cloud, very clearly silhouetted against the evening sky, a submarine. And so we turned towards it and flew for about 9 miles, and it made absolutely no sign of having seen us at all. So we climbed into the cloud and came down right on top of her and released our two anti-submarine bombs that we were holding. One was an absolute direct hit and went bump, 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 bump along the hull of the submarine and fell harmlessly into the water. And the other one was a near miss ahead. Dud bombs. However, the submarine had a rude shock, presumably with the noise of thumping metal on the hull, and did an emergency descent to the bottom of the ocean as we machine gunned it.
And that was at the end of the Dakar raid?
End of the Dakar raid, on our way back to Freetown.
So, off the West African coast. Well,
the submarine, I think, was a Sidi Farouk, S-I-D-I-F-E-R-R-U-C-H. I read that up in a book. I reported it as being an Italian submarine, because on its hull it had a red, white, and blue, and red, white, and green flag, which is, of course, Italian. I think it was just a blue that had got obliterated a bit by water, seawater.
And then comes Spartivento, I think?
Yes. That was, we were doing a convoy through to the East Med. I can't remember if it was Malta or Alexandria, when a report came through that there were Italian ships. First it was thought they were our own ships from the Eastern Med, but it was confirmed later on, I think by a flying boat report, that they were enemy ships. And 810 Squadron was ranged with torpedoes to go and attack them. And all the capital ships set off to intercept. And there we saw this Italian fleet of two battleships, I think the Vittorio class and one of the older ones, at sea with about three cruisers and a screen of destroyers. And somehow or other they got the buzz that we knew they were there. And they turned round, beautiful, like toys being maneuvered in this beautiful blue sea. Maximum visibility everywhere there. And they started to move eastwards again, back to their base. My goodness me, they could steam. You could see below our ships absolutely turning up the whole ocean. And an old World War I battleship in our unit trying to keep up. I think she only had a maximum of 20 knots, and she was getting further and further behind as the Renown legged away. And we had to, of course, come from astern. That's where you really felt the Swordfish was so jolly slow. In order to gain bearings, you always had to attack from ahead, because otherwise you dropped your torpedoes astern. Torpedo only did about 35 knots or something like that. If the target was going 30 knots, you probably would never get there. So we had to gain there, and it took absolutely hours. No, it didn't really, but it seemed like hours to gain bearing. And we worked, managed to, the sun was in the right position. We got right up sun and then came down on these two battleships and their screen. And there wasn't any response at all until we were actually on top of the screen when one of the battleships saw us and opened fire. And there we were, but it, in such incredibly bad luck. That, or not bad luck, misjudgment or something, but we didn't score a hit because we were inside the screen, you know, between the destroyers and these huge ships belting forth all the bangs in their armoury. Our torpedo actually went off in the wake. There was a big bluff of dirty water, but apparently no hits.
How were the torpedoes released in those days?
They were just mechanical release. You know, they had a sort of, when you pulled a wire, it was an electrically operated release on top of the torpedo. And just let go of the hook and it fell down. You had to be at a certain height, going at a certain speed. And it had an air tail that kept it sort of in a reasonable oscillation.
Did the release mechanism ever fail to operate?
I expect it did, but not in my knowledge.
Which month would that have been?
That was November.
1940,
yes.
And then after that attack?
Well, we just returned, and I reported one hit, because I thought it was, you know, this dirty water shooting up.
But then you launch a torpedo attack on the Tirso Dam in Sardinia.
That was a night attack. Very bad weather. I'm surprised it wasn't cancelled. And we lost touch with our colleagues. I think there were only three of us, a very small unit. And the idea was like what later Group Captain Gibson did on the, I've forgotten the name of the dam. Long before that, I remember watching the torpedo drop on this lake, and I didn't even see it hit the water because it was so dark. There was a bit of flak from the dam at the end going up, which might have been one of our colleagues. We lost one, but I think the crew was safe.
So that was 810 Squadron which did that attack?
Did that attack, yes.
The whole squadron?
No, only about three aircraft. I think it was largely a diversionary attack.
Was there much enemy opposition?
Well, a lot of flak from the dam, yes, but nothing worried us. I don't think they were aware that aeroplanes were there. I don't think they were shooting for anyone in particular. Certainly not at us. Whether they got this chap who landed. And how he came down safely, I don't know, without hurting anybody.
What happened to the dam?
I don't think if anything, the torpedo probably went into the mud.
Which month was that in?
I can't remember it was probably winter's month, I should think.
The winter of 40-41?
Yes, yes.
Had you had to fly very far to get to it?
I should think about 120 miles or something, yes. That probably a round trip of about 3 hours.
And then you've written here that you bombed Spezia?
Yes, that was when Admiral Somerville took his Force H up to the off the French-Italian coast to bombard Genoa. And the big ships, the capital ships, bombarded Genoa with aircraft spotting from the Fulmars, that's our fighter squadron. And we went down the coast to Spezia to bomb the naval installations there. And we were told that there were no balloon barrage. And as we turn to the west to escape, you know, towards the dark from dawn, away from the rising sun. You could see these balloon barrages in front of us, and one of our aircraft did pick up a barrage, and the crew were killed.
What could you see about the targets that you hit in Spezia?
I can't really remember much, except that we did hit buildings in the dockyard.
In which of these was the flak the worst, do you think? All these various
Oh, against ships. Always the flak was worst against ships.
Why should that be so?
Because it's so concentrated, I think. And you see, a number of aircraft are hitting the same precise 200 yards, whereas in a land attack, it's more diffused, yes.
They don't know where you're going to go.
They're going, no.
And then you've written here again the location of the Scharnhorst tanker Polycarp and the search for the Scharnhorst and Meissenau.
Yes, we were on, done a reconnaissance that day, and we sighted this tanker all on its own with SOS chalked on a deck house, and we flew round this ship, and there were only about three sailors, merchant sailors on board. They were all very grim, you know, no waving at all. We thought it was a bit odd, so we had a look at it and reported it. We didn't break wireless silence. We just said a suspicious ship, and it was later identified as a German being a supply ship.
Whereabouts in the ocean was this?
Oh, somewhere in sort of central Atlantic, yes. And that day, I think it was that evening, one of the Fulmars sighted the Scharnhorst and Meissenau. Unfortunately, it had a radio failure, and everything was sort of was held up, and it was too late to do a strike in the circumstances. And we did a reconnaissance next day. It was in pouring weather again. And I was on, I think, a northerly leg. And I remember looking over the side and saying, God, there were two large ships below me. And I took my eyes off them to look at my plot that I was keeping, to note the time and put a tick before I got out my binoculars, or got up my binoculars, to make a closer search and start initiating the enemy report. And they weren't there. They just weren't there. So I thought it must have been imagining the clouds and things. Just nothing at all. I often wondered whether, you know, that I should have gone down and told the pilot to go down, but the weather was so bad, I thought we might get into navigational trouble.
How difficult was it to do your observer's job in 1941 with the techniques you had available to you?
I think that the difficulty was that you had to do an awful lot at the moment, and you had to take action. Particularly if you were without a radio man to work the radios, as with a long-range tank, you know, had to coat up, keep the navigational plot going, draft your signals. You didn't just write them out in plain language. You had to use a self-evident code, which had very little security, but you use, for any amplifying reports, you had a numbers, which was sort of what the enemy was doing. If you put 439 for enemy is forming line ahead or something like that. And then you were supposed, after your initial reports, to code it up into with a, what was known as a psycho box, which was a tin box about the size of a child's large paint box with a card of jumbled figures and letters and a cursor on top. So you move the cursor with your the actual language you wanted to send and then read it off what the jumbled letters were otherwise, were below, and then send that out by radio. And it took an awful lot of time. And if you dropped anything on the deck of the cockpit, it was a major physical operation to retrieve it. And you, of course, you had continually to watch the surface of the sea for signs of the wind changing. And if the wind did change, you had an elaborate maneuver that you did to find the wind again and then plot allow so much back for the change of wind. When you thought it, if you found the wind had changed, you say, well, 10 minutes, that must have changed 10 minutes ago. You had very little assistance except for a beacon that you could tune in to, or and you got a bearing from just a straight bearing from the ship.
I've just been referring to your logbook, and I discover from it some dates which are helpful. You attacked the Tiso Dam on the 2nd of February 1941. At 600 hours, and you attacked a coal oil plant at Leghorn, that's Livorno in Italy, on the 9th of February 1941.
That must have been the Spezia attack. Is it Leghorn anywhere near?
Not quite sure.
Leghorn, is it awful?
Leghorn is Livorno.
Livorno,
the Italians call it Livorno. And then again, you sighted the Polycarp on the 20th of March, 1941.
Yes.
That was, you give that as 7:35 hours. And then searching for the battlecruiser Scharnhorst and Gneisenau on the 21st of March, 1941. Now, in your notes here, you've put next that we come to the Bismarck hunt, which was, of course, May 1941. Can you tell me what your own part in that was, please?
The background to that was just about the time the flying boat, RAF Catalina, sighted them, we had launched a search in the expected direction of the Bismarck. I don't know whether it's two or three swordfish, and they came up with a sighting report very shortly after the Catalinas, and to relieve them, I was flown off, not with my usual pilot, David Godfrey Fawcett, but a sub-lieutenant Crabb, and another aircraft with a midshipman, I think his name was McWilliam, as observer. We were flying about, probably about, on tracks, about 20 degrees apart, to make sure, you know, we picked up. And we sighted the Bismarck and made our sighting reports. We were using long-range tanks, which meant that we sat in the gunner's cockpit with the long-range tank in our cockpit, and they were just strapped on the, literally on the top of the fuselage. So they pushed into our backs, and we were like that with the radio close up against our knees. There was a vent to the petrol tank, pushing out nasty, smelly petrol fumes. And we had to do our job there, the usual observer's job, and work the radio, this dreadful psycho coding box, which in my case, very quickly dropped to the deck and then worked its way miles out of reach. However, the initial sighting report is a very simple method of just saying from so-and-so, one BB, one BS, one battleship and its bearing, followed by a confirmatory report of the battleship and its bearing and distance from you and your position. Well, that is fairly simple. And thank goodness, after that, if there was no change, you were allowed to get away with just making your call sign twice, about every 20 minutes. That signified, A, you were in touch with the enemy, and there was no change in the situation. So any codings or working out of new messages and things was obviated, thank goodness. And I told the pilot, this sub-lieutenant, not to lose touch while I was working the radio, to keep the Bismarck in sight and to keep it at the distance we were, which is probably about 5 or 6 miles. And at one time we flew across his, or fairly frequently we'd fly either across his stern or across his bows, and you'd look down your compass and the bearing, and that gave you his course, and he remained on the same course the whole time we were in the air, which is nearly 5.5 hours. That's, we met the RAF flying boat at fairly close quarters through a cloud, and sort of parted quickly. And at one time, I got my head out of the office. You know, I've been doing the radio, and found nothing in sight at all. And once you made contact with the enemy, the navigational technique was you plotted the enemy rather than yourself. So if you wanted to know the position of the aircraft at any moment, you got the plot of the battleship going 20 knots in a southerly course or westerly course, whatever it was, and then if you were north of it 5 miles, that was your position. It was much better than trying to keep a track of your several alterations of course through cloud and getting a better position from here, and frequent alterations as you changed your viewpoint, so to speak. So I think our sub-lieutenant Crabb must have just lost sight in the very bad weather prevalent. Fortunately, we sighted the Sheffield. We didn't know that she'd separated from the rest of Force Age. And I came up on the lamp and said, enemy bearing and distance, please. And they gave it back, and so we recovered the Bismarck. And about that time, I could hear coming up on the radio through my earphones rather obscure signals from aircraft in the air, which of course was the air striking force that went and attacked the Sheffield just after we'd left her. And I couldn't make out what this was. And after 5.5 hours, the position of our own base, the Ark Royal, was getting a bit obscure, because I mean she was nowhere near where she would have been if we just continued her PIM, position and intended movement, plot. So we'd no idea where to get back to her, other than possibly picking her up on our radio beacon. At that moment, when I was beginning to, you know, we were having to get back on board, because fuel was beginning to get low, even with a long-range tank, I heard my colleague, Midshipman McWilliam, ask for a bearing. You normally were only allowed to break wireless silence for enemy reports, but of course that was no longer in effect now we'd found the enemy. And I heard the ship come back with a bearing, and at that precise moment, by pure coincidence and all that weather and sky, McWilliam flew across our stern. So we just turned to the course that he'd been given and came back on board after 5 hours, 35 minutes in the air, with petrol fumes blowing in your ears. for all that time, and one was so incredibly mentally flogged with sort of exhaustion of sort of keeping tab of things. One must have been a zombie for the next 3 hours.
You realize the importance of...
Oh yes, one thing you simply must not do is to lose touch or to miss any alterations. So you had to keep the enemy target under continuous observation the whole time. Watch out for any alterations, of course. She was slightly down by the head, but it was a most magnificent ship. And the other thing, of course, was worrying me in case they decided to launch their Arado seaplane, which, of course, was vastly superior in performance to a Swordfish, with many higher caliber guns.
Why did she look so magnificent?
I just don't know. I always thought German ships did look fine, very tough.
But the head was down.
The head was very slightly down. I think a slight oil slick from the previous damage.
Did you go up again?
No. As we landed, there were a lot of people, traffic in the corridor to the crew room, in the operations room, where I had to go to report. And I said, "What's up?" And I saw my normal pilot, Godfrey Fawcett. He said, "Oh, we're taking off for the strike." And he said, I said, "I'll have to go and come and join you." And he said, "Don't do that. You've had enough, and I've got so-and-so." And quite honestly, I didn't, because I don't think I would have been much use.
What happened on board the Ark Royal when you heard that the Bismarck had been destroyed?
Well, I think there was a general feeling of satisfaction. Also a feeling of sort of frustration, because 810 was airborne, and I think some others, 818 Squadron 2, with torpedoes, to go and do the coup de grace. And we weren't called on at all. And we had to land back. And the flight deck stern was moving through 50 or 60 feet with the movements. They landed on with their torpedoes, and I don't think there was any undercarriages broken or anything, which speaks very highly of the flying ability of the pilots.
When did you leave the Ark Royal? Was it soon after the Bismarck hunt?
I think
you found the date from your logbook.
Yes, the date was July the 10th, according to my logbook. I took passage home in a converted merchant ship called Marsdale, which is an ocean boarding vessel. It's a 6-inch gun each end, whose job had been to intercept neutral shipping and put prize crews on board or crews on board to take them into a friendly port if necessary.
Then you went away to a course at Arbroath.